Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. This week, my special guest is Jules Boykoff, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. In 2006, he was an invited speaker at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Nairobi, based on his research and writing on media coverage of climate disruption. Jules is the author of three books, the most recent being Landscapes of Dissent, Guerrilla Poetry and Public Space, with Kaya Sand, published by Palm Press in 2008. His writing on activism has appeared recently in New Left Review, The Guardian, Oregon Historical Quarterly, The Nation and Counterpunch. Jules Boykoff has also written two books of poetry, Hegemonic Love Potion and Once Upon a Neoliberal Rocket Badge. He is currently serving as poetry editor for Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. Jules Boykoff, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you.
So you're a professor of political science, right?
That's right.
Well, now, how did you get into the whole issue of dissent and media cover-up and the like?
Well, I grew up in a family that was interested in such matters, and we talked about it a lot around the dinner table. I have parents that were both politically active and that were supportive of people who had the courage to stand up and take positions that weren't necessarily popular in the public sphere. And they taught me growing up that it's important to do such a thing, to stand up when you believe you're right, but also to be willing to think about what you're standing up for and adjust your stance when necessary.
You mean speak truth to power?
That's right, and hopefully eventually speak power to power. And yes, but at the same time, like I say, when you need to have time to reflect and think about what you're doing, engage in praxis, reflection, and then action again. And so I was definitely taught that at a relatively young age. Yeah.
And also to be able to think critically, which I think has been subjugated to a degree because of television, which everyone sits and watches for hours at a time. Not everyone, but most people. And, you know, the images come thick and fast, and it goes straight through the neocortex into the sort of midbrain, and there's not time to process everything or really think, and your brain goes into a state of sort of alpha wave activity or almost being anesthetized.
Mm-hmm. Although there's been some really interesting political TV lately here in the United States, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and on their respective shows have been doing quite a bit of, I think, pretty effective political satire. Although I would also say that perhaps Jon Stewart's biggest blind spot on The Daily Show is the way that he talks about dissident citizens who stand up for their rights. But maybe we can talk about that later.
Well, no, let's talk about that because I watch Jon Colbert and Stewart. You can get them in Australia, but also when I'm in America, that's all my son watches. He tapes them, and after he's put the babies to bed, he watches Stewart and Colbert. So tell us the way Jon Stewart treats dissidents or people who
speak.
Yeah.
Well, first, I think you can glean quite a bit of political news from watching the shows. And in fact, statistics show now that many young people are doing just that. That's how they get a majority of their political news.
That's good.
And one thing that's, I think, also important before I sort of launch my critique against what Stewart's been doing in terms of covering dissent. Let me just go right into that, actually, because basically what he tends to do is he looks at dissident citizens and he conflates their strategies and tactics if they happen to be outside the mainstream. He conflates those, which is to say falsely equates them with radical ideas that shouldn't be considered. When he doesn't see it in the bigger picture, where a lot of times activists are taking on tactics and strategies that come out of frustration with trying many of the other channels that just simply haven't worked, and therefore have had to up the ante, if you will, in an attention to get media coverage and do things that are a little bit out of the norm, at which point Stewart then turns around and says things like they're acting too crazy and we therefore shouldn't take their ideas seriously.
Really?
We saw this in how he covered Madea Benjamin and Code Pink. I mean, these are activists who we should be thankful for. They've stayed on the issues of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and they haven't given up. They haven't let it fall off their radar. And yet for him, because they put fake blood on their hand and hold it up during hearings, we shouldn't even listen to what they have to say anymore. And then, you know, recently with what's been happening in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, which is actually my hometown. I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, so I've been watching the protests there with a great deal of interest. But on a recent show, Stewart kind of stopped, wagged his finger at the protesters and said, you know, he was basically making light of the fact that some of the signs said things like Hosni Walker, making the tie between Egypt and Madison. And Stewart sort of stopped his comedic routine and just said, look, people, in a very serious way, not funny at all, there is a big difference between Egypt and Wisconsin, you know, as if protesters in Wisconsin were saying it was the exact same thing. Of course they weren't. They were just pointing out that there were similar dynamics at work in both situations. So I guess what I'm saying is, while I really appreciate Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert in terms of what they're able to do, in terms of their ability to bring critical thinking into practice, you mentioned critical thinking before, I think that a lot of times when they cover dissent, they just kind of miss out with the nuance and they just fall a little bit flat, especially Stewart is really who I'm talking about.
Well, why do you think he does that then?
Well, I'd love to actually get a chance to talk to him and find out, but it seems to me that he's basically just reinforcing the brackets that say certain people are engaging in acceptable behavior and certain people aren't. I'd love to have a chance to talk to him and figure out why he does that.
Yes, so would I. I'd love to go on his show, actually. What about Rachel Maddow? What do you think about her?
Well, she's certainly one of the smartest journalists going, and I have a lot of respect for her, actually. And she asks tough questions. I think she's actually doing the job that journalists should be doing, asking tough questions to people who are in positions of power and not necessarily being blinded by her own beliefs. I think she's a strong journalist.
Is she getting more and more people watching her?
Well, I'd have to look at the numbers. I mean, yeah. It's not going to hurt her that Keith Olbermann has now left MSNBC, and she's kind of the big dog left, if you will, there.
What about Ed Schultz?
Ed Schultz, my Midwestern brother, you
yes.
know, I think actually he catches a lot of flack from Jon Stewart as well, but simply, again, because he tends to raise his voice and say things in a way that are uncommon. And, you know, it'd be hard for me to disrespect my Midwestern brother here on your radio show, but he does tend to go kind of over the top and then leave himself open to criticisms from people like Stewart and others. But, I mean, his content is very strong. I think he's got a really smart critique of the way that corporate capitalism has come to dominate our country in ways that we don't even think about it anymore. It's just sort of the octave humming in our breakfast cereal now known as normal. It's just corporate capitalism.
Yes, I watched Ed Schultz talk about Madison and why the hell Obama isn't going. And then he showed a clip of Obama on the campaign trail saying, I will stand with the unions, I will get a pair of comfortable shoes and march with the unions.
That's right.
And he counterposed that with what a pathetic little thing that Obama said, you know, yeah, well, okay, it's sort of freedom of speech stuff. And he said, Obama, get there, go there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very powerful. And I thought, why on earth aren't people speaking the bland open truth? Why are Americans so intimidated, Jules Boykoff? What is it? Why does everyone have to conform and say the right thing, and eccentricity isn't accepted? And even on the Jon Stewart show, if you step out a little bit from the norm, you know, you're rubbished, you're made fun of. It's a strange sort of society where everyone sort of does the right thing, has their teeth straightened, and everyone says, have a nice day, or whatever you say these days. Do you know? What is
sure.
it, do you think?
Well, I think there's at least a couple things I think we could talk about. And one of them is that we're in the middle of a real deal economic crisis. People call it the Great Recession, and it's hitting all around the world. And so in times like this, a lot of people will just hold on to what they have and just sort of buckle down and say, I'm not going to take any risks now. I'm going to hold on to what I have, play it safe. Now's not the time to speak out at the workplace and lose my job, try to unionize at a place that's not unionized and therefore come under the wrath of the boss. So I think the economic situation on one hand might be preventing people from speaking out. On the other hand, you might think that the fact that we've had it pretty straightly told to us that we've been taken advantage of by those on Wall Street, and now people don't have jobs and in a sense nothing to lose, you'd hope at least that there'd be a movement building in the United States at least against what we've been seeing. So the economics of it seems to me to be one place to maybe think about it, but the other, and I'm inclined to look in this direction based on a lot of the research I've done, is sort of looking at the longer view of the history of suppression in the United States. You mentioned intimidation, and that's certainly one of the outcomes of a long history of political suppression. And that political suppression can come in pretty direct forms, like violence, when the police shoot political dissidents and tear gas them, as happened not too long ago, not far from where I live in Seattle, and during the World Trade Organization protests. But that's actually quite a bit more rare, I've been arguing, at least in the context of the United States, and that there's all sorts of other ways where dissent is suppressed, I mean, that are much subtler. So that's why the most recent book I wrote on that topic is called Beyond Bullets, The Suppression of Dissent in the United States. So we need to look beyond the bullet, beyond the bomb, beyond the baton, and look at the subtler ways in which it happens. And I think that could also, Helen, take us a great far way in understanding why we have a certain degree of quiescence right now when we would hope to not.
I'm interviewing Jules Boykoff, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. But there's something else. You know, I've lived in the States for 18 years. It's more like my home than actually in Australia, politically, certainly. But there's something else. See, in Australians, we just shoot straight from the mouth, so to speak. We say what we think. We're unabashedly honest and funny and sort of skeptical, and eccentricity is interesting. Whereas I find in America, they're awfully nice people. I really desperately want to do the right thing, but have been conditioned, I think, from birth that, you know, America's the greatest country on earth, that it can do no wrong. But it's more than that. It's everyone conforms to a certain standard that critical thinking and expression of that outside the norm is kind of not tolerated. I find that quite strongly. And then when I go to Germany, you know, everyone looks sort of, their teeth are all crooked and people look really different. There's a sort of uniformity of conformity in a way that I find not just in appearance but in the way people feel able to express themselves. And when I give a speech, and I just speak as an Australian, you know, I just speak the truth as I see it. A lot of times, especially young women come up to me and they say, you've just said everything I've ever believed. And I say, well, why don't you say it? And there seems to be an underlying fear. Can you talk about that, Jules?
Well, sure. Fear plays a big role in politics.
But what is the fear? What is the fear? What are they frightened of?
Well, for one, if you listen carefully to the politicians who are behind the microphones in Congress, they'll tell you that you need to be afraid of the other. You need to be afraid of the immigrant. You need to be afraid of people who are different from you. And that's pretty much drummed into our heads almost every day when you turn on the TV and the radio. So it really, in that sense, comes from the top.
Yeah, but, you know, there's something else. I've read a lot about immigrants coming to the States over the generations, and the children were kind of taught at school, you've got to speak English and you've got to be American, and they had to go home, or they did, and taught their parents how to be American and sort of move into the American mode. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
There's something underlying. Anyway, I think that, let's talk about the current state in the States at the moment, sort of the capitalistic, feudalistic system. I read an incredible article yesterday quoting, comparing today with the rich getting richer and richer and richer, the 1%, you know, owning, what, 50% of the wealth or something, to and the poor and the middle class getting poorer and the poor getting poorer, to the Grapes of Wrath, when John Steinbeck wrote that great novel during the Great Depression. And the quotes from Steinbeck were absolutely superb and stunning and heartrending. And he said at that time the rich landowners were forcing people off the land, and it wasn't just the Great Depression, it was also the accumulation of great wealth by very few. And I read that and I thought, now how did people recover from that and take back their liberties and their freedom from that suppression of the tremendously wealthy? How did that happen, Jules?
Well, for one, I mean, it never happens by one person acting alone.
No.
It's always, at the very base level, to answer your question, it's always people coming together, linking arms, staying up late during meetings, strategizing, making plans, attending meetings, fighting in the streets, talking to the people who they've elected, putting pressure on them. It always has happened that way. But getting at your thing about really what you're talking about is the accumulation through dispossession that happened during Steinbeck's era. And I think we are seeing a replication today of that accumulation through dispossession. And you need look no further than the housing situation, the housing bubble, which was blamed quite a bit by many commentators on the people who bought the homes instead of the structure that was created to create these loans to give to people that probably shouldn't have been taking them. And so, again, you give people then have their homes, and now we see accumulation, again, through that top 1%, 2%, through dispossession of people. And I think that if you really want to understand the sort of the recent history of capitalism over the last 100 years is basically what you're talking about, you have to look at that accumulation through dispossession kind of dynamic. But, I mean, there's all sorts of exciting movements going on right now. Right in my home state of Oregon, there's a lot of smart talk about starting an Oregon State Bank as an alternative to some of these big banks that have done us no favors whatsoever. We've got a thriving credit union culture. I mean, when you think about the names of the businesses and the banks and those firms that went under, can you think of credit unions? No. And that's because they didn't go under like the banks did. So there are alternatives out there, and there's new creative ones that are being thrown about right here in Oregon. The Oregon State Bank could be the next big thing for us. And, you know, meanwhile also, I mean, you want to talk about accumulation by dispossession. I mean, let's not forget about the Aboriginal peoples of the world. Australia, certainly.
We're the worst. We're the very worst.
Mm-hmm. And not that the United States is anything to get too excited about in terms of how that all played out, nor Canada. And, you know, in terms of thinking about hope, though, First Nations peoples in Canada played a really, really smart role in something I've been looking into over the last year and a half. And that is the really smart, principled resistance against the Olympic Industrial Complex, which I think is a mega event that basically does this accumulation through dispossession, Helen, that you and I are talking about. And maybe I could talk about that, because it actually was a really smart, thoughtful force of resistance that I was following and heading up to Vancouver quite a bit, and I found it quite inspiring, actually.
Okay, so I want to get into that, the Olympics, shortly, but I want you now, Jules Boykoff, to comment on the Wisconsin situation and how it's spreading across the country. And do you think it will be sustained? Do you think it's inspiring people? Do you think people will come out, the homeless have been dispossessed and the like? What is your prognosis for the descent that is happening which began in Wisconsin?
Yes, I'm happy to talk about Wisconsin because I'm totally excited about what's going on there. My dad still lives in town, and he's been sending me protest signs from the protest.
Oh, sweet.
I'm looking right now in front of me at a recent issue of the Wisconsin State Journal that he sent me, which was the hometown paper I was weaned on. So what's interesting, I think, in a lot of ways, and really hopeful for the practice of dissent, you know, all around the world, but certainly here in the U.S., is when you look at Wisconsin, it's not necessarily just a Democratic thing going on or a left-of-center protest movement. Because a lot of what Scott Walker has tried to push, basically getting rid of collective bargaining for union members will affect people on all parts of the political spectrum. And so what you've seen is people coming together, Republicans, Democrats, and people on the left and right of them, and coming together and saying, you know what, we're going to stand up to this guy. And this is the sort of issue perhaps we could hinge a really strong, smart fight back on that then from there takes on some of the bigger issues about accumulation by dispossession, the corporate power in the United States. Because, you know, when you look at what's going on in Madison and you look at how they've actually put their bodies on the line and taken over the Capitol, think about all the micro conversations that are happening.
Yeah.
I mean, when we watch it on the news, all we get is sort of the bigger picture. We get it framed by some media worker, journalist doing the best sheer he can. But think about all the little, small, important, I would argue, conversations that are happening in the Capitol building among people who would otherwise not have the chance to talk. People from all different parts of society, people who are teachers, people who are janitors, people who are unemployed, people who are Republicans, Democrats, you name it. They're actually now engaging in conversations, and hopefully that's the kind of thing that can build a really strong movement for the future in Wisconsin. Because, you know, even people like that were Republicans now are speaking out and saying, yes, I voted for Scott Walker, the Republican for governor, but I would not vote for him today. In fact, I'd vote in a very different direction. And you can't help but think that a lot of the micro conversations that people are having are swerving minds in the right direction, correct direction.
That's a lovely thought, Jules. But I hear, and this we are taping this conversation, so it won't be played for a couple of weeks, but today, I think in the New York Times and other places, they're saying that Walker is backing off to a degree. Is that true?
Well, from what I've read, he's certainly not backing off on the collective bargaining.
Oh.
In fact, he's saying that he's going to, he just had his big budget talk recently and said that there's going to be a lot of monies taken out of education.
Oh,
again,
God.
This is something that's going to hit people, Wisconsinites, across the political spectrum. I mean, cuts to education don't discriminate by ideology or by your political party. And there are a lot of people in Wisconsin who are utterly upset about this. I mean, look, Scott Walker's son, his teacher, was out there protesting.
Was he?
Yes, she was. So.
Yes, she.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing is that he's just a puppet of the Koch brothers, who really are very, very scary, aren't they?
I think what you're referring to is the fake phone call, which really was scary. I mean, just to back up a second and for your listeners, I mean, this Gonzo journalist called him pretending to be one of the Koch brothers. And, well, one, I thought it was interesting that the Gonzo journalist actually was patched through and got to have a conversation with the governor, who seems utterly unwilling to talk to other people of different political stripes. And second, it was very alarming what he said in regards to being open to the possibility, that he thought about the possibility of essentially sending in goons to stir up trouble. This didn't settle well with the population in Madison, certainly the protesters, to hear that your governor was thinking about putting your safety at risk. And it also didn't sit very well with the police officers in Madison, in fact. The Madison police chief is asking for an audience with the governor to talk about this. And in fact, Matthew Rothschild, who's been all over this, he's the editor of the Progressive magazine in Madison, he's looking into whether this could in fact be a breach of law, what he did in terms of conspiracy. So this is no small thing. It might have been done in a sort of tricky and perhaps dubious ethically way to get the information, but it's quite instructive what Scott Walker had to say when he thought he was talking to a power broker.
Yeah, and Wisconsin, of course, is one of the most liberal progressive states in America, which is also fascinating. And I just want to bring in another subject, Jules Boykoff, and that is all this sort of artificial nonsense about deficits and having to fire teachers and nurses and God knows what, while the American public is still spending $1 trillion of their tax money a year on the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
And Eisenhower warned about that so many years ago, and virtually nobody has the guts, and I say that advisedly, to take on that wickedness. I mean, the Pentagon is the Department of War. It's not the Department of Defense. And it's to maintain the American empire throughout the world. And it's just ridiculous. Why doesn't anyone have the courage to speak up about this? Because that's where the money's going.
Well, I would say one thing that's been happening is that the debate has been reframed by people who are concerned with the fiscal deficit, and a lot of that has to be given credit to the Tea Party movement. I actually just finished with Eulalie Lashever, sociology major who's starting graduate school this year. Eulalie Lashever and I did a 22-month study of the way the Tea Party movement was covered in the press. There was actually a really interesting piece in the Washington Post. They did a survey of people who are in the Tea Party and asked if they thought the coverage of them was fair, and the Tea Party members said, by and large, like basically 3 out of 4 said, yes, it was. So we tested that, and we looked at how they were covered in the media, and in fact, they were covered in ways that were very positive for their movement, and one of those was that the media tended to stay with the Tea Party's idea that they were all about reducing the deficit and having frustrations over fiscal issues in an all-too-big federal government. They didn't talk about a lot of the other issues that surrounded, like, for example, trying to get rid of what they called Obamacare. That was usually set to the side, in fact, and the media allowed the Tea Party movement to really reframe things to their advantage in terms of thinking about deficits. And this had a big effect. I mean, you know, you might not agree with the Tea Party's principles, but they certainly showed us how it can be done as a movement to reframe the debate in directions that they want. Now, do I think that's a positive way to think about things as we're in this situation? No. And do I think that the deficit needs to be looked at in terms of military spending? Absolutely. I mean, that seems to be the no-brainer. And I think that actually what one thing that's interesting about the Tea Party movement is that there are a few people within the right-wing Tea Party movement who are willing to actually make real deal cuts to the military budget. So there is sort of a libertarian strand. They're very small, and they're getting basically boxed out and domesticated within Congress right now and pressured by the other people who are Republicans in their party. But they did do a job in terms of reframing the debate in that direction. But I think that the way you're talking about it is certainly a way that we should all be talking about it. And it makes sense to people. It's totally logical. You can talk to your uncle, who's the right-wing uncle who you can barely talk about politics with. You can explain this to him. He can understand that.
How much money you spend, the percentage
we're spending of our budget on war, the Department of War, as you put it.
It's not just the Department of War, of course. The money goes to Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and all the rest of them. I mean, and cleverly they've put their factories in every single congressional district in the country. So then they can say, well, it's jobs, 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 and it ties up the Congress. But someone's got to take this on full frontal, absolutely full frontal. And that's what I'm interested in, because that's the thing that's sticking out like a sore tooth. It's the elephant in the sitting room that's never discussed.
Well, yeah, war is essentially a corporatized franchise that you buy with public money.
And it's nationalism, you know. Anyway, let's not go into that. There's another thing I wanted to talk about, Jules. Jules Boykoff is the Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. You know how Iceland dealt with their dreadful depression and collapse because the banks all collapsed? They made the banks pay. They didn't reinforce and support the banks like America did, because the banks all said, oh my God, you know, the whole economy will collapse if the banks are allowed to go under. They let the banks go under, and they forced the banks, and I haven't got all the details, to cover the costs and bear the brunt of the problem. And they're doing better now than Ireland, who is going under because they had to borrow from the EU to support their banks, a huge, I don't know, $35 billion or something. And it strikes me that that's the next question. Why don't the Americans rise up and say, for God's sake, it's the banks that did us in with these, you know, pathetic loans and derivatives and goodness knows what, and forcing people out of their houses, and rise up against the banks and the great wealth that is really running the country. Why would people be intimidated not to do that?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I would say that pointing to Iceland and other places, there are viable alternatives that we can point to of ways of moving forward on this. And, you know, maybe one of the reasons why we don't have people jumping up and down and asking for something different is because those alternatives aren't necessarily getting a lot of play in the mainstream media and the mainstream conversations that are happening out there. So it's easy to jump up and down and blame the banks, and we should. But then the people will then say, well, what's the next step? I mean, what are we going to do here? And there are lots of great ideas. I mean,
yeah.
There's all sorts of ways of reallocating the wealth and deciding who's going to get the support from the government and who's not.
It strikes me that the people in Wisconsin and New Jersey and Indiana and Ohio who are demonstrating now and being dissident, so to speak, could look at that very deeply and work out a strategy and say, now this is our next move.
Well, and I think that's what activists should be thinking about right now, is how to jump scale, if you will, how to move between scale. What I mean by that is, you know, how do you link what's happening in your location so you have something to talk about with people around you? How do you link what's going on there with these bigger questions that you're bringing up, Helen, about, you know, who profits in society, who benefits in society, who do we prop up? And by that, I mean the federal government. Who do they prop up? And I think that is sort of the way forward out of Wisconsin, out of Indiana and elsewhere, is this sort of scale bending where we can connect up these things, connect the dots, as Donald Rumsfeld famously used to say.
Well, then you have to look at intimidation of dissenters on climate change. You've written a lot about that, and how the big banks and huge wealth manipulate society and get rid of dissenters so that things remain on their side. Would you like to discuss that somewhat, Jules Boykoff, because that's what you've been writing about?
Sure.
The elimination of dissent, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I've had personal experience with some of the entrenched interests after my brother, whose name is Max Boykoff, who's at the University of Colorado, he and I came out with a study in 2004 called, basically looked at the idea of balance as bias, global warming and the U.S. prestige press. And what I mean by that as bias as balance as bias, rather, is that the media tend to look at whether humans were causing global warming in a balanced way. Like, you know, on one hand, it could be humans causing it. On the other hand, it's not. It's just natural cycles. When we know, and even then when we did the report, scientists, a huge percentage of them, 97-98%, the ones who go through the peer review process, they were saying, yes, humans have a significant role in the evolution of global warming and the rising temperatures around the Earth. The small percentage that disagreed happened to be people, many of them, who were funded by companies like ExxonMobil and others. And so you might expect them to speak out in favor of those who are paying them. And so what happened was we put this through a peer review study. This little old journal, this academic journal, published it. And then the media actually took an interest in it, and it became part of the news. And when we were in the news a little bit, and it was interesting that right as soon as it became part of the more public discourse, you had people trying to bring us down. In fact, there was an environmental reporter who sent me an email. He was interviewing us for the story and said, you know, I want you to know that there are people out there that are sending emails that are negative about you and your brother saying all these things. And I said, oh, gee, would you mind sending one on to me? I promise I won't say where I got it. Sure enough, the individual sent it to me. And it was just one of these lobbying outfits, that, you know, the kind of outfit that protects the ability of corporations to put additives in gasoline that poisons well water across the United States, MTBE. It's that kind of thing. And you know, they went right after us. I mean, when you're talking about entrenched interests here, even this, I was sitting in my little old office, in my little academic office, and then they came out strong. The Competitive Enterprise Institute wrote negative things about us. And it's not just about the work. It's about us as individuals.
Yes, they attack you personally. So were you intimidated? That's what's happening to me at the moment. Someone's hired a PR firm to deal with me. And I could talk about that later. But were you intimidated by what they said? And what did they actually say about you personally, Jules?
Well, they just said that we were, you know, a couple of young researchers who didn't know what we were talking about, and they could provide all sorts of people who do know. And it was, you know, they trotted out the list of people who are these so-called climate scientists who had been questioning global warming for a long time, the names that had become common at that point. Richard Lindzen, go down the list. I won't even make like McCarthy and name him here. But and did it intimidate us? No. I mean, actually, I mean, I just kept on going with what I was going to do. I stand by that research, and I think it was strong research. We put it through the peer review process. I had nothing to be ashamed of. Mm. I thought it led to interesting outcomes, and I was going to stand up. I mean, I did take quite a bit of heat from it. I mean, you mentioned that I spoke at the UN conference in 2006 in Nairobi. And one of the people on our panel was Rajendra Pachauri, who's the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He won the Nobel Prize along with Al Gore a couple of years back.
Yes.
And there was also a gentleman who basically elbowed his way onto our panel at the very last minute. He was the communications director for Senator James Inhofe, who at the time was the head of the Environment and Public Works Committee. And this strategic director said, "Hey, you know, you're not letting any alternative voices on. You let me on." And so they let him on the panel, actually. And, you know, he proceeded to do ad hominem attacks against Rajendra Pachauri, saying that he was naive when it came to U.S. politics. He had all sorts of negative things to say about me, too. And it really kind of derailed the panel.
You should have just marched him off physically.
You know, it was interesting because it was an international audience. I mean, it was a UN conference.
Yeah.
It was a packed hall because of the fact that Rajendra Pachauri was there. People were interested in seeing what he had to say.
Yeah.
And it was people who really knew what was going on. And they sort of acted with disbelief, like, oh, if we tell this guy a few more facts, we'll be able to convince him that, you know, he just must have not seen the most recent study. So people would raise their hand and, you know, with total goodwill, yeah, but have you seen the new Arctic study? And this guy, you know, he was not going to be convinced. There was nothing you could say. I mean, he was on a mission to basically muddy the waters. And that's what's interesting with a lot of these entrenched interests. And maybe this has been your experience, too. They don't even necessarily have to demonstrate that you're wrong.
Talk about the nuclear industry. They lie through their teeth. They lie through their lips. They lie consistently all the time. And they scare the bejesus out of me. I mean, talk about death merchants selling mutagenic products which will affect all future generations with cancer and genetic disease. It's really frightening. And you know what we're talking about, Jules, reminds me of the tobacco industry. Remember those eight people standing up before Congress with their hands on their hearts saying that tobacco doesn't cause cancer? How long did it take us, the medical profession, to convince the public finally that smoking causes cancer?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I started medical school in 56, all my colleagues were smoking, and soon after, the data came out about lung cancer, and of course we saw it in our patients. So that was like 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What's amazing too, Helen, is actually some of the people, the scientists who were involved in trying to muddy the waters and say that cigarette smoking actually, you can't prove that it caused cancer, are the same individuals who popped up again and reared their heads during
really?
The global warming debate. Some of the very same individuals.
Oh, really? Oh, they've sold their souls like Faust. Now, I'm fascinated by your experience with the Vancouver Olympics. Would you like to outline that, Jules Boykoff?
Oh, yes. I'd love to talk about it because, as I mentioned before, I found it really inspiring. And I went up there over the course of a year numerous times and interviewed numerous activists and kept very close tabs on what was happening. I also interviewed people who are journalists, who are civil libertarians, people across the spectrum about what was going on in Vancouver.
And what was going on?
Well, it's interesting because first, you know, when you think of the Olympics, you normally just think of sort of happy people doing their best and their best in the sports. You know, and I should say as background, full disclosure, I mean, I represented the U.S. Olympic team in international competition on the soccer team. So, I mean, I used to be an athlete as well. So, I mean, when I was an athlete, I had no idea that there was sort of an alternative history to the sport, which includes all sorts of things like racism and colonialism. And in the case of what happened in Vancouver, something that was really interesting to me, at least, was that there was really smart, principled resistance on Indigenous issues. If I had to break it down for you, Helen, I would say that there were three main areas that people were expressing their dissent. One of them was around the fact that, as the slogan went, the Olympics were taking place on stolen Native land. So the slogan was, "No Olympics on stolen Native land," because British Columbia actually has a unique history. Unlike a lot of other parts of Canada, the treaties were never actually completed, and so the land was never officially ceded to the British Crown, except for one exception in 1898 and then another, the Nisga'a people, in the year 2000 or so. who did reach a treaty, but otherwise the land had not been ceded. So in a sense, the Olympics were happening on Coast Salish territory.
Mm.
So there was a real effort on the part of activists to constantly mention the fact that we were on Coast Salish indigenous territory. So that was one of the really important strands. Second one was regarding the economics. I mean, you and I have been talking about economics, the economic crisis, and what happened in Vancouver was, well, basically, the you know, as one of the activists who I interview, his name is Am Johal. He's a really smart guy from the Impact on Communities Coalition. He said the Olympics are a corporate franchise that you buy with public money. Mm. And what he meant was, you know, gosh, Canadians were paying through their teeth in terms of taxes to make the games happen. And the prices just kept going up and up and up. And no doubt about it, the economic collapse in 2008 came at a really bad time for the organizers. But they had already been lowballing how much it was going to cost. So there was the whole economic side of it that really brought people out and together, too. Because, again, we saw already people had to make cuts in schools all around
really?
The province.
Oh, really? Oh, my God.
Only the causality challenge couldn't see the connection there between putting all this money in and then having their schools' music programs cut.
Oh, dear.
Then the third area was civil liberties. I mean, as you see with these mega events, it basically becomes a ticket for local police forces, regional police forces, and even the national government to get a whole stockpile of brand new weapons and toys that they
really?
Get.
Really?
Oh, sure. So, you know, you have things like what are called the LRAD or the MRAD, the long-range acoustic device and the medium-range acoustic device. These are incredible pieces of technology. They're produced by a company. One of the companies that produces them is called American Technology Corporation. And basically, it just is a focused beam of sound that essentially pierces your ears. It's used in Iraq. It's like a piece of military-grade hardware that places like Pittsburgh have been purchasing in order to aim at dissident citizens during the G20 protest in 2009. Well, Vancouver bought themselves an MRAD, a medium-range acoustic device, that they said they weren't going to use. And a really interesting story, and I think important story for us who are interested in resistance to these kind of measures, civil libertarians and activists of all stripes came together and fought this MRAD thing. It became public that they had it, and there came all sorts of pressure, spearheaded by a group called the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association. A guy named David Eby was big in this. Michael Vaughn is another woman who was really big in fighting against the MRAD and keeping them accountable and, you know, moving forward with lawsuits and all sorts of administrative pressure through law. And it turns out that during the games, the police and the special unit that was set up to police the games, it's called the Vancouver Integrated Security Unit, they actually kept the MRAD in the box. They didn't use it. And, you know, then there's a reason why. And that's because the activists stepped up. They organized early and often around the issue. They reached out. There was cross-cutting solidarity among activists. And they actually stopped its use. But this is a scary instrument. And so the general trend is that you see police forces cashing in. I mean, this is your time to get all the weapons that you always wanted. And what's important to remember is that these weapons, they're purchased for the so-called state of exception of hosting the mega event, in this case Vancouver Olympics. They're bought during the state of exception, but
used
then they just
later.
Become there
yeah.
for day-to-day operations.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what's scary for the practice of dissent in the future. But the people in Vancouver were tremendously courageous, and you know that those wide-ranging groups I mentioned before stood up together and were actually very successful at raising awareness among the general population regarding the Olympics. At the same time, without discrediting the amazing athletes and athletics that were happening. So it wasn't really, when you call them anti-Olympic activists, it wasn't as if they were all necessarily sports haters or something like that. In fact, a lot of them were rooting for the Canadian hockey team to win the gold, but their critique was much more subtle. It was about what some people have called the Olympic industrial complex. And so I thought what they did was quite smart.
Yes, we could go into the Olympic industrial complex, but time is short. What about, here's another subject you've written about, the U.S. media coverage of Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. Would you like
sure.
to discuss that somewhat?
You bet. So, I mean, I was just curious. I mean, I listened to the U.S. media quite a bit, probably all too much for my own health, but And it seemed to me a lot of times when I would hear a report or see one on TV, it was really negative about Hugo Chavez, and it would say things like he was a dictator, always hanging out with Castro, he was ruining the economy and kind of messing up the region of South America. So what I decided to do was to systematically test these media, mainstream media, meaning the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, over a 10-year time period. And I did what's called a frame analysis to see what the dominant frames that the media used when they were covering Hugo Chavez, who, as your listeners know, I mean, he has spoken out vociferously against U.S. interventions around the world. And you know, Hugo Chavez has done some things. When he spoke at the United Nations, you may recall, he said as he stepped to the podium that he smelled sulfur. It was after George Bush had spoken the day before, I believe it was. And so, I mean, he does these unconventional things that some people may find lacking in diplomacy and the kind of courtesy that you might expect from world leaders. But nevertheless, we looked at the study, and basically I found that more than half of the articles portrayed Chavez as a dictator, which I thought was incredible given the fact that he's been elected through democracies that have been deemed free and fair numerous times. Yet he was still, I think it was like 53% of the articles found him to be a dictator or a demagogic dictator. So that was interesting. And then another one of the dominant frames was that he was considered to be a Castro disciple. Now, there's no doubt that Hugo Chavez is friends with Fidel Castro. There's no doubt whatsoever. But what was interesting to me, I mean, this occurred in, I would say, one in three articles. It would be discussed where Chavez is friends with Fidel Castro. And what was interesting to me about that was that it would occur in articles where Castro had absolutely nothing to do with it. Hmm. I mean, if you're talking about an article about the relationship between Chavez and Castro, well, of course, you're going to discuss their friendship. But it was being used in articles where Castro wasn't even being discussed at all. It was just this sort of little hint to you that the journalist was giving that Chavez hangs out with somebody who, by and large, has pretty negative approval ratings. You know, in 2002, 78% of the U.S. population assigned Castro an unfavorable assessment. So there was a sort of Castro disciple frame that was very common. You know, they called him an heir to Castro. A Castro wannabe is another expression that you see. A Castro apprentice or protege or that sort of thing. And then the third dominant frame was that the Venezuelan economy was going down the tubes, and that was because of the personality and character of Hugo Chavez. And that was in another third of the articles found that frame, when in reality, if you look at the economic data, like the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR, has done, the media were just getting it wrong on that. And just to personalize it as a Chavez thing anyways is just sort of misleading. And then, you know, the last thing that I found was that about a third of the articles portrayed Chavez as a meddler in the region, kind of a troublemaker who was always kind of stirring things up, challenging the good institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, that is, and basically, you know, not being compliant in the war on drugs, these kind of things that would sort of be negative about him. So by and large, the U.S. media, meaning the Washington Post, New York Times, and Wall Street Journal, didn't really give, in my estimation, that great or a nuanced of a look at Hugo Chavez, because he's a tremendously complex guy, and there's a lot to write about, but it tended to kind of sidestep some of those more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's using his oil money to look after his poor people and get them educated and feed them properly and get them medical care. I mean, that's absolutely not on, right?
Well, and especially, you're exactly right. I mean, it points to what we were talking about before, that there are alternative ways of doing things. There are alternative ways of spending the money that your government captures through taxes and other means. And
for the people, of the people, for the people, and by the people.
Right, and of course, the most vicious attacks when it came to critiquing what you're talking about came from the Wall Street Journal, which was essentially the sort of neoliberal watchdog.
Which is now owned by Rupert Murdoch.
Indeed.
And being used as, you know, his propaganda tool. I won't go into Rupert Murdoch at the moment, who happened to champion my career in the early 70s when I was taking on the French for testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere in the Southern Hemisphere. And he quoted me in front page editorials in the national paper, The Australian. So he helped to create my career, so to speak. But when I started talking about uranium mining in a couple of years later, and we've got 40% of the world's richest uranium, he turned against me. So that was an interesting thing. I mean, you can talk about external enemies, but you mustn't talk about your own problems or, you know, why shouldn't we mine uranium? Everyone needs a four-car garage and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you were mentioning before that you've been attacked and they've been trying to suppress your dissent and intimidate you recently. What were you mentioning? What were you talking
about? Well, there
are
several things. When I was president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which I founded, the new organization, we were infiltrated by the FBI. And at that time, there became or developed a lot of dissent on my board. And we actually got the documents from the FBI, pages and pages and pages, but they're all blacked out. All they were the prepositions and, you know, and but. And so I don't know who that infiltrator was, but then I resigned under duress, great duress. And I rang a friend of mine who, John Stockwell, actually, who had just left the CIA, and told him, and he said it was a classical operation, but you'll never find out. So that was the first thing. And, of course, I got attacked all over the place for saying that we must get rid of nuclear weapons. But like you, it didn't bother me because I know when I'm speaking the truth, I have this deep sense of contentment in my belly, I suppose, that I know that what I'm doing is right. Then recently I went to this town in Canada called Port Hope, of all names, and that's where they started refining radium there in the early 30s and since then produced the uranium for all the American nuclear weapons from the first bombs that were ever exploded right up to 57. And they're now producing uranium for nuclear fuel rods and exporting them all over the world. And any country that has a reactor then has access to plutonium and can build nuclear weapons. And anyway, there was a huge amount of radioactive waste, of course, from these operations, which the government at the time, the Canadian government, which ran the operation called El Dorado, dumped all over the town, millions of tons of it. They used it for filling in houses, filling for schools, playgrounds, dumped in ravines. And the town's radioactive. So I was interviewed about this. And I said, the town should be evacuated. Well, you can't believe it. I am the messenger of ill tidings. And they call it the Caldecott effect. And they've now, and of course, Cameco really runs the town. They're the ones, the biggest uranium producers in the world who are making these fuel rods. And their factory towers over the town like a huge sort of Gothic legend in a way, emitting uranium still over the town. And they've hired a PR firm to deal with me, the Caldecott Factor. So it's kind of like the tobacco companies, and it's kind of like all these think tanks that have been set up by Exxon and the like to counter the scientific facts on global warming. So if you don't have an argument against the actual facts and you can't argue scientifically, then you attack the messenger.
But I
feel sort of okay to me because it's like being on Nixon's blacklist, you know?
A badge of honor.
And you know you're on the right track when they resort to that sort of tactic.
It actually brings up some interesting questions for activists about, you know, how to proceed forward and how to figure out ways of sharing information that are safe from potential infiltrators online.
Well, I've learnt the hard lesson. If you have an organisation and it's all going well and everyone's excited, enthusiastic, they argue, but it's positive discussion. If someone comes in that sows seeds of dissent, you use your radar and you just kick them out because almost always they're a troublemaker, they're psychologically disturbed, or they've been put there by the powers that be. And I don't discuss it or, you know, I don't believe in fairness now. If anyone comes in to start to destroy the organisation, they're out. So you learn from experience, and that's what I would advise people to do. Watch out, you know, when you And keep your organization small, because then you, the ones that you have, you can really trust. You know, you can really trust. And we've, you know, the truth is we've got to have a revolution. And it's kind of, I know what's happening in the Middle East is absolutely astounding. But maybe it's starting in America, where the people are going to rise up and say, okay, our tax money is to be used for us. It's not going to the Pentagon to kill people anymore. And we're going to educate our kids, and we're going to have decent hospitals, and medicine should be free like it is in most other Western countries, paid for by our tax dollars, and take on the very wealthy. It's hard. And I remember there was a guy called Harold Lasswell. I don't know if you've read him.
I have, yeah.
Historian way back. And he said, if the powers that be lose the chains of iron, beware the chains of silver. And that means using their money for propaganda, taking over the media. And that's really what's happened. And if people wake up to that, and it feels like maybe they are. So would you like to comment on that, Jules Boykoff?
Oh, well, Harold Lasswell is a fascinating person. He wrote a book called The Propaganda Technique in the World War, where he had all sorts of interesting stuff to say. In fact, I quote him at length in my book Beyond Bullets, and this is just a quote from him that I happen to just have right here. He said, Harold Lasswell wrote this: "It is no longer possible to fuse the waywardness of individuals in the furnace of the war dance. A new and subtler instrument must weld thousands and even millions of human beings into one amalgamated mass of hate and will and hope. A new flame must burn out the canker of dissent, and temper the steel of bellicose enthusiasm. The name of this new hammer and anvil of social solidarity is propaganda." And, you know, I would say that we need to counter that, his social solidarity of propaganda, with our own more equitable form of social solidarity.
That's right. And it was Edward Bernays who really developed this propaganda way back in the First World War. And he was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. And he told me proudly one day he taught women how to smoke. And I said, how? He said, I put cigarettes in their hands. I put them in glamorous green gowns in the pages of Vogue. I nearly vomited on his lap as a physician. So anyway, look, that's propaganda. I've written about it too in my book, If You Love This Planet, and you have too. Do you have a website, Jules, that people can go to?
You know, I think, I actually don't. You could go to my website for work, and you can access a lot of what I've written there, though.
Well, give us the website.
Well, I think it would just be at Pacific University in Oregon. I think if you just did a search engine search for my name, Jules Boykoff, B-O-Y-K-O-F-F, it would come up, and you could get a lot of my writing through that.
Thank you very much, Jules. It's been a fascinating conversation, I think, right on the knocker, as we'd say in Australia.
Okay,
right to the
you.
Point, very topical, and thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
My guest today on the program was Jules Boykoff, Associate Professor in the Department of Politics and Government at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. Thanks for listening, people, and we'll be back again with you next week with another fascinating interview.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.